This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, why some scientific conclusions are not always conclusive.
Scientists can look at exactly the same bits of data and interpret them in completely different ways.
Coming up, the scientists' editors talk about two instances when the point of view can bias conclusions. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and you're listening to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. First, in news this week, Penn State University geneticist Nina Fedorov will assume the position of science and technology advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State this month. The scientist Bob Grant reports on Fedorov's goals for her new job.
Condoleezza Rice, the current Secretary of State, appointed Fedorov, who will serve as advisor for 3 years. She is the third person and the first woman to take the post since it was created in the year 2000. Fedorov said that in her new position, she'll seek to inject science into U.S. foreign policy decisions and to encourage more international scientific collaboration. Fedorov studies plant stress response, transposons, and epigenetic mechanisms at Penn State's Huck Institutes of Life Sciences. She declined to discuss specific goals, but she did say she'll try to use her 3 decades of genetic research experience, and particularly her recent work on biotechnology and crop plants, to help ease agricultural woes and encourage growth in developing nations.
When people can't even grow enough food to feed their own family, international development and education are difficult to accomplish, difficult to even get excited about. Helping the poorest countries that have been left behind by, in a sense, a green revolution is something that is very important.
Fedorov also has more than 20 years of experience in science advisory roles both in the U.S. and internationally. She said that one of the biggest challenges she'll face in her new post will be to emphasize scientific discussion early on in the sometimes short-sighted policymaking process.
Short-term goals have trumped the longer-term perspective of precisely how we power our civilization and the balance between climate, energy production, energy consumption, where the energy comes from, how we use it, how much of it we use.
Norman Neureiter, the first person to serve as science and technology advisor when the position was created under Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, has offered Fedorov advice for success in her new role. I asked him if she was a good choice for the position.
She has the experience, the capacity, the background, the strength, and the smarts to do it, and also the linkages to the community to back her up.
That was Bob Grant reporting on Nina Fedorov, the new science and technology advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State. Go to thescientist.com to read more on this story, and while you're there, check out the August issue of the magazine, which comes out this week. Two of the features in it bring up an element of science that isn't always easy to talk about, and that's bias. As part of our monthly editorial roundup, editors Ivan Oransky and Richard Gallagher met in the studio to tell us how the issue cropped up twice in the August issue of the magazine.
Hello and welcome from me, Richard Gallagher.
Hi, this is Ivan Oransky.
And we are the people that are ultimately responsible, I suppose, for the content of The Scientist. And we're going to talk about what we've lined up for this month, a couple of highlights from the August issue of The Scientist. And actually, although there's no theme in the issue, there is something that binds together two of the main pieces that we're publishing. And that's the way in which scientists can look at exactly the same bits of data and interpret them in completely different ways. And the examples come from two very different fields. One, which I'll talk about a bit later, is the impact that systems biology can or cannot have on the drug development process. And the other is looking at experiments in captive chimpanzees and trying to assess whether they do not indicate that chimps have a form of culture. Do you want to talk a bit about the background to that story, Ivan?
Well, it's a very interesting subject, of course. Anytime you talk about chimps or any kinds of monkeys and talk about whether they might have some similarities to humans in behavior, obviously there are similarities in physical characteristics, but in behavior, people's ears tend to perk up. And actually, I think, Richard, what had happened was over the past several months, I had noticed a couple stories about chimp behavior and other monkey behavior, other ape behavior, and you had noticed some as well. And the stories were sort of starting to gel about whether or not chimps actually had morality, whether monkeys had morality. The alliteration sort of helped us think about this a little bit. And so Bob Grant is also interested. He's one of our staff writers who did this piece in the August issue, which is called, Do Chimps Have Culture? And Bob was looking at some of these studies and poking around a little bit and talking to people. And we all got very excited about this idea about morality. But actually, this, and I think this points out what you're saying, when he started really talking to people about some of the data and some of the terminology they were using, the idea of morality among monkeys was actually met with a little bit of, I wouldn't say, sort of extreme skepticism, but there was a significant amount of sort of question about whether this was true. And if it turns out that what really ended up happening with the story is that we focused on culture because there is more evidence that people do tend to sort of agree on about culture. And the idea is that culture may be a perquisite for morality. In other words, if you don't have culture, which by the definition here, and we'll talk about what definitions mean here and how important they are, the definition here is basically the ability to essentially teach a skill or a sort of behavior to someone else, among you. In other words, we can train monkeys the same way we can train, dogs. But when humans are doing it, that doesn't mean that simply because the dog or the monkey is doing something that we've trained them how to do, that you have culture. However, if you train a monkey how to do something, which is what happens here in the opening of the story, and then that monkey trains another monkey, that chimp trains another chimp to do something, that is basically kind of at least the lowest common denominator of culture. So if you have that, you might therefore have morality, which of course is a sort of shared ethos, if you will. So that's, but it was interesting to watch, if you will, the evolution of the story, because we really had sort of morality in mind, but it's actually turning out to be much more robust in terms of the culture.
Oh, the fact is that nobody disagrees with the experiments. The experiments are very clear, right, on all sides.
Absolutely.
It's just what you want it to mean. And that's really, do you think that there's a genuine scientific disagreement here, or is it just... is it just a difference in language? What exactly is going on? I mean, let's look at two quotes. Bennett Galef says, "We're building cathedrals and walking on the moon, and they still sit naked in the rain." So
it's obviously a
doesn't support culture.
Well, it's obviously a sort of soundbite-ish quote, which we pulled out as a pull quote, but it does say something about subjectivity, because obviously you can't talk about culture without having your own sense of what culture is. But if you look at another quote, Franz de Waal, who's probably arguably the sort of leader of this field, he says, "In science, we push limits, We say, let's call it culture because that's what we think it is, and then others can try to debunk it." And that's, to me, that's a sort of honest response to, here's my data, I'm going to put it out there. If people don't feel it's culture, let them make arguments about it.
The whole thing reminds me of a story of the tourists, American tourists in Ireland, driving through a village, and they're lost, and they pull up beside this old man walking down the street, and they say, "Excuse me, sir, can you tell us how to get from here to Ballykiss Angel?" He says, "Well, now I would, but if I were you, I wouldn't be starting from here."
There's a similar New England version of that, which is, "You can't get there from here," is sort of the punchline of that. But you're right. I mean, it's what are you looking at, and is it the way that someone else might look at it? But, Richard, you mentioned when we started talking here that there's another story in this issue that I know that you were quite keen on, really just to learn more about it yourself, and that is about systems biology. And, we've written about systems biology before. It's a bit of a catchword, a buzzword, if you will. But you were particularly interested in should pharmaceutical companies be using systems biology in drug discovery, and if they should, and are they, and what is Wall Street saying about this? And Brendan Burrell, who went out to a conference on this and then met with some other people here and there, put together a pretty good picture of it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I'm a bit of a systems biology junkie. I think that at least in the basic idea, it's incredibly compelling and exciting. Mm. But then when you look into the detail, you find that it's such an onerous task to describe any sort of biological system, even the most simple thing, in a way that's comprehensive enough to be called systems biology. And so what happens is exactly what I've just described there. The discussion about systems biology in general, and particularly how it might be applied practically in drug discovery, becomes very polarized. On the one hand, I found a marketing document from a company trying to sell a report that basically says, you know, the solution to the dwindling pipeline in pharmaceutical companies is that they need to apply systems biology and everything will be very much better. And then on the other hand, Brendan went out and spoke to some analysts and they were incredibly skeptical and said that they've never seen, I think someone gave a very terse, I've never seen a project that I thought was in any way interesting and hung up on them. And again, everyone's looking at the same sets of data, but they're interpreting it in very different ways. So what we wanted Brendan to do was go out and find out exactly what's going on, almost company by company, to see who really is in favour of systems biology and who isn't. And in fact, one of the reasons for me doing this is that we regularly publish supplements in The Scientist, and I'd approached a number of companies with a view to supporting a supplement on systems biology. And while everyone professed to be very interested in the subject, and in fact to have some internal R&D looking at systems biology, no one really wanted to stick their head up above the parapet and say, okay, we're doing systems biology here. So, unfortunately,
and why was that?
Well, because they don't want to be seen to by Wall Street and by other analysts as being going after this kind of airy-fairy area. On the other hand, when you look at Brendan's story, there are some topics where you can see that, depending on how you define systems biology, it is beginning to take a grip, and we'll certainly be following it over time as we see more mathematical approaches and more modelling being brought into drug discovery.
No, absolutely, and you know, our readers will sort of, you know, remember the story of Iressa, which is really still an ongoing story. I think there's still some questions about Iressa, but that's, of course, AstraZeneca's cancer drug, anti-cancer drug. And in some ways, this turned into a sort of, I wouldn't sort of get too excited but about sort of systems biology here, but certainly systems biology helped sort of at least figure out what was going on. And had it been applied, one of the arguments in at the beginning of this piece is, had it been applied earlier in drug development in terms of Iressa, maybe, you know, we would have targeted it better or what have you. So I think it's quite interesting.
You know, going back to the theme of you say tomato, I say tomato, is it systems biology?
Exactly.
I mean, how do we want to look at these things? So I do think that how you define things and how you want to think about what science means really has a very big impact on what your attitude is to different areas of science, especially these very grey areas like systems biology and like the development of culture in primates. It's fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. And to shift gears a little bit, we just want to briefly note this week the passing of one of science's great lights, and that science can be lowercase s or uppercase s, as our readers will no doubt know by now. Daniel Koshland passed away last week, I believe it was Tuesday. Richard, we ran an obituary, of course, the following day last week. And Richard, you knew Dr. Koshland, you worked with him, and what do you recollect?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that he was an incredibly influential person in my career and my attitude in the careers and the approach of all the people that worked with them, certainly at Science. I'm sure we all remember him, and I've had email exchanges with some of my former colleagues there. I mean, we remember him as a tremendous leader incredible intellect. I mean, I was swapping email stories about the meetings. We used to have these weekly meetings. We called them space meetings, although that in itself got us into a lot of trouble with authors. But we used to
calling it space meeting?
Yeah, because the idea that we divvied up the space every Thursday morning or whatever didn't go down well with people that had spent their years working on their particular piece of paper. That was just our shorthand. But in essence, it was an incredibly intellectual environment where the 15 or 16 editors covering all the physical and life sciences would sit around and talk about what was most exciting, what papers they wanted to publish and why. It was a phenomenal education for me. I mean, I think at that time I knew more about science than I've ever known in my life, and probably more than most other people knew at the time. So you felt incredibly grateful for being in that job, and Dan Koshland kept things at a really high intellectual level. He would jump all over you if you didn't know what you were talking about, which frequently happened to me. So I remember him not only as being someone who taught me a lot, but a very warm and personable individual as well.
Absolutely, and from all the reports I've read, I did not know him personally, but from all the reports I've read and just talking to you about it last week in the office, certainly someone who will be missed by science as a community as well, obviously, at the Journal. More coverage of science, different things going on there. You'll know by the time this podcast goes live, a little bit of an update on the search for a new editor of science. Obviously, not Dan Koshland's replacement. There have been a couple editors since then, but Donald Kennedy, is stepping down as soon as a replacement is found. So that search is ongoing, and Cary Grant's reports on it this week. So tune into our podcast next week. In the meantime, check out our website for daily news, some other interactive things that we have going on. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
That was the Scientist's editor, Richard Gallagher, and deputy editor, Ivan Aransky. We always want to hear what you have to say. Go to our website and let us know. Right now, we're particularly interested in what you think are the best places to work in academia, and also how science should be sold to the public. The address is www.thescientist.com. That's all for the Scientist Podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.